say guilty, more often not guilty, but when they do say guilty, some people it's 99%, some people it's 100%, some people it's 90%, 80%, even down to 51%. So it shouldn't be 51% because it's not balance of probability, but the failure to stipulate or numerically define means that this is open to interpretation. And the fact that jurors want an answer, like you said, but don't have it, is an additional challenge. The truth is, there are so many of those things. That's an important one, but jurors just simply struggle with instructions. Instructions are complicated. The language used and presented to jurors is difficult. In the trials we've been doing, based out of Lancaster Law School, we found the route to verdict document that all jurors now receive of 12 separate jury panels that watch the same male-on-male rape case, only one of them appeared to use it, and the one that did was the one that convicted. The others that didn't did not convict. And so, this is part of also the process for me that we as a justice system globally say that when we instruct jurors, that's what they do. We say that we provide jurors with all the information they need and they make use of it. And my argument is always, how could you possibly know? How do you know? How do we know? Jurors are off limits. And so we assume that when you direct them to do X, Y, and Z, they do it. But when we do studies like those realistic recreations I do, what we tend to find is they don't do that. So if jurors are not doing what they're instructed to do, and those instructions are designed to deal with a particular problem or issue, then that is evidence of a lack of efficacy among jurors in the process they're supposed to follow. But yeah, so an obvious solution would be jurors return their verdicts and we ask them to provide a justification for that verdict. Then we get to see if they've really interpreted the law. And what we'll probably find is they've misinterpreted the law, and that will highlight how fundamentally flawed and biased jurors often are. But there is a reluctance even for jurors to say guilty, not guilty, and then provide a one sentence summary of why. And I think the reluctance comes from the fact that it will reveal how flawed jurors are in their decision making.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, I remember the huge stack of different papers I was handed when it was kind of, it was a route to verdict, it was the charges, it was instructions on other things that, yes, the judge reads through the whole pamphlet, multiple pamphlets that you're given, but it is also very overwhelming on a jury when you've like been handed such a severe case and then just a whole load of paperwork that's using a lot of legal terminology, things like that. And I definitely felt this, but I think a lot of the jurors around me felt it as well, in that there was this emphasis on a fear of getting it wrong. And you're handed all of this paperwork to kind of ensure you don't get it wrong. But it was,
It's cognitive overload.
yeah. And the judge reading through it didn't make it any easier to understand because he just read word for word what was written in front of us. And so I think there is definitely a big, I'd say, pitfall in juror comprehension of the
For
legal
sure.
instructions. And also, as you said, people don't utilize it. I know, and it was very openly said during my trial, when we left, but one of my jurors was asleep for the whole thing. So, and because like no one wakes them up and they just stay asleep, you've got to think, well, he's definitely not understanding the instructions because he's definitely not listening. So then how do you go about that as well, of people not wanting to utilize it? Also, I would say one other big thing was that what I found, and I remember talking to you about this, is that the trial was the last thing on everyone's mind, pretty much. They were all thinking about, wow, I'm getting way less money than if I was actually going to work. And then when you're late getting into court and it's like you're an hour delayed and you're thinking, right, well, I could have gone and got this much money and I could have got out of bed later, or this is just like a pain for me, it's an inconvenience for me, and this, that, the other, that you realize they don't actually care to understand the trial. They don't actually care to understand the instructions and how to be an effective juror because it's the last thing on their brain anyway.
Yeah, and that's a real another really important point here, that you and I are having this lengthy discussion here, and you've spoke to lots of others, and I'm constantly in contact with other lots of amazing jury researchers and other people that look at this process because we're fascinated by it. We want to improve things, but general public who are legally mandated to serve as jurors, whilst they will watch the latest crime show or the latest show looking at jury decision making, perhaps it's not their primary focus. They have their lives. People's lives, especially now, are difficult, complicated, challenging. Everyone's struggling for money and all the rest of it. Lots of health stuff going on for lots of people. So, whilst for us it's a core priority, Studies suggest between 85 and 90% of UK jurors, at least, don't want to serve as jurors. They'll do anything to get out of it. So motivation to listen and get it right is also an issue. And so, yeah, comprehension of instructions, desire to be there when most jurors actually would prefer not to be. They're financially worse off in some cases by being there, like you said, as well as the fact this stuff is hugely challenging, hugely complex. High levels of variability in terms of educational attainment. You're a young woman who is going through uni process and very intelligent and able to been trained to critically analyze and evaluate. There are other people who you can't apply that to them. And I would say lots, perhaps most jurors, even just like the ability to listen for prolonged periods of time at quite cumbersome wording and terminology, and then make sense of that, synthesize it, and there's, but nonetheless, each juror has an equivalent vote. So, yeah, there is the problem, right? That not only myths and stereotypes and negative attitudes towards complainants of rape in this case, but even just motivation, desire to be there and to get it right, and the challenging task that is being a juror. Emotionally, there's a lot of work going on in the UK at the minute. My colleague Hannah Bowes at Durham University and Anna Fawcett and Matt Brooks at MMU University are looking at things like jury trauma, because jurors are serving in cases that give them PTSD. So, and they're legally required to be there, and they're legally prevented from discussing the consequences of that case. They can't discuss conversations during deliberations that may have led them to feel traumatized, because the law prevents them from. So the whole process has got fundamental issues, and yeah, it's super challenging, but it's important. And I have to say, there have been many occasions working in RASO jury space. So by RASO, I mean rape and serious sexual offences, where I think, I can't do this anymore. Like, it's too tough, it's too emotionally draining, it's too challenging. We generate this evidence, and policymakers don't want to listen because it's not real jurors, but then they prevent us speaking to real jurors. And I will get and I'm sure lots of other people working in this space have similar experiences here. I'll then get an email from somebody whose case has gone to trial. They know they were raped, and the jury return a not guilty verdict, and they will say, "I googled what the hell was going on with jurors, and I found somebody, lots of you, with doctor before your name, saying that there is a problem here, and now I feel okay." Like, it's not perfect. I would prefer, of course, to have got a guilty verdict that I know I have. But the fact that there is somebody out there that's, to some extent in a position of authority, or at least has doctor before their name, that is saying there is a problem here, I feel vindicated. I left that process feeling like nobody believed me. The police questioning made me feel like the police didn't believe me. Prosecutors dragged their feet and heels. The case took forever to get to trial. They didn't believe me. Defense lawyers tore me to shreds. They didn't believe me. And now the jury said not guilty. They didn't believe me. But I know I was raped. And so the fact that there are researchers and lots of fantastic researchers around the world working on things like juries, but also prosecution biases and police investigations. There's a great study going on in the UK called Operation Soteria, Project Bluestone, with there's like 40, 50 predominantly female academics that are working on radically reforming policing in England or Wales in rape and serious sexual offence cases, show that this work does have an impact. Sometimes it can be soft impact, and that soft impact is it gives victim survivors some sense of there are people fighting for me here, even if I didn't get the outcome I deserve. And so, yeah, in my own case, every time I'm about to chuck it in when it comes to juries in rape cases, because I feel like I'm getting nowhere, one of those emails seems to come through from a victim survivor who's had a really tough time. And I think, we are making progress, we are helping people, and therefore let's just keep plodding along and, slowly chipping away. There's a fantastic psychologist, Barbara Crahey, who's been working in this space for around four, I might be exaggerating there, a long time. She's been publishing in this area for a long time. Don't want to make her sound older than she is. And we recently did a PhD examination together, and I said, you've been working on this stuff for a long time. How do you have you lost, lost your will, lost your way, felt like we're not getting anywhere? She said, just keep chipping away. We're making progress. We're way better now, in some ways at least, than we were 20 years ago. And so in another 20 years' time, even just inspiring the next generation of researchers behind us, people like yourself, Rebecca, to say this isn't a problem, we're going to focus more and more efforts, create more and more evidence, and hopefully we'll start to slowly chip things forward and make a positive impact. But yeah, it's challenging to feel like we know all this stuff and there isn't rapid, meaningful change.
Yeah, and I think because the research as well, you're all looking at the whole criminal justice system as having issues, that that's such a big institution, which is going to be an institution that isn't going to want to admit it's got issues and pitfalls, in that that's going to make it even harder and longer to get reforms out of it. And since we were talking about the kind of more in-depth on a trial process, there was kind of one last, I would say, principle or term in a trial that I wanted your thoughts on, whether you think it kind of unconsciously fuels the rape myth bias of that females are more deceptive and more likely to lie in rape allegations, in that our justice system is based off of the fact that the defendant is innocent until proven guilty. Do you think that has an impact in such high acquittal rates that we see in rape and sexual assault cases because of this myth that women are more likely to be lying when they give an allegation of rape?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not convinced that we should change the burden and standard of proof so that, I mean, it certainly feels very far in favor of the defendant. And we're talking predominantly in rape cases about a man who's alleged to have perpetrated a rape offense against a woman. So the odds are certainly stacked in their favor. I don't think we should necessarily, I'm not a believer we should radically change that. But I do think it's gone slightly too far in their favor. And so, efforts for things like greater training for jurors to tackle and debunk myths and stereotypes towards rape, where there is evidence that they're having a detrimental, prejudicial impact, should be help, should be implemented to try and slightly weigh the scales in, not entirely in favor of the defendant, not such that they balance it so that it's not fair and the defendant's not getting a fair trial or presumed to be innocent. And other interventions like trauma responses and trauma-informed experts. So yeah, I certainly think there are things we can be doing, and the fact that that myth that you mentioned in particular there is having a massive impact. The truth is, public information and education campaigns is the key to all of this. And so educating children and young people, one, about consent, and two, about challenging these stereotypes from an early age. And there's been some great examples in the UK where Coronation Street, EastEnders, Hollyoaks, those sort of popular shows include even like posters to rape crisis centres in the back shot. But storylines around male sexual victimisation, female sexual victimisation, and so really get into the details of these things helps with this public awareness campaigning. A part of exactly what you're doing here today is part of that, right? That we're trying to raise awareness around these things that I know about these things from going to university and learning about them, studying and reading about them. Before that, when I was a young person growing up in Nottingham in quite a deprived area, I had no knowledge of these things, and I endorsed a whole host of rape myths. So until it's not a criticism that people endorse these, but it is a reality that they endorse them. And then when they're selected for jury service, they bring those with them. So I think public information and education campaigns in the process itself, when you're selected to be jurors, as well as national campaigns and education at school, is really how we deal with this problem long term, so that myths like lots of women are walking around looking for a man to rape are not having the detrimental impact that we know that they are. The other problem is the media will, false allegations happen. They happen infrequently, but when they do happen, they have a severe impact on those lives and the individuals that have been accused, of course, and their families. But they're often quite widely publicized in the press, and they kind of compound, and and that raises the focus in the media and in the press, means that they perhaps get more traction than they deserve. And that's not to say that they don't have a massive impact on the lives of the innocent people being accused, but they happen infrequently. Like, the bigger issue here is not one of false allegations, it's one of genuine allegations not being preceded in the criminal justice process and victims not being believed. So, yeah, I think greater awareness around those things, That's the key issue. And you know, getting schools on board. I've done some work in previous projects I was on where we lobbied the Department for Education in England and Wales to try and take on board some of this consent training. And even like, you know, we developed like computer games as part of a project called the None in Three Project, where we were trying to tackle young people's negative attitudes and attitudes that were supportive of gender-based violence through gameplay. And we had some fantastic game designers, huge amount of money for that project, £4 million, to develop these really fancy games, education specialists that did this wraparound curricula. And then we went around the country, myself and a colleague called Jill Kirkman, basically trying to give this game and curricula for free to schools. And almost all of them said no, thank you. And they said no, thank you, because what do we do if we accept this? Do we now admit that we've got a problem? Are we legally responsible? As well as from one end of the continuum all the way to the other, where they said, we don't have a problem with that in our school. So lots of issues. The government were looking at mandatory consent and sex education and to deal with some of these more prominent issues, but gave so many opt-outs for mandatory education around this that it meant that it's been infrequently applied. And that's the key issue. And that's also a key issue driving lots of sexual offending. They're not all predators walking around looking to pounce. And you know, we do have those predatory individuals out there, but a lot of cases it is people, young people who are intoxicated, who don't understand the law around consent and don't understand how it works. And so education really is the key to all of this. But effectively rolling out that education and having people receptive to it again is another massive challenge.
Yeah, and I've spoken about this over here before about the issue of consent and consent education, because I look back on when I was having sex ed classes and consent classes, and that was back when I was in secondary school around like age 14, and I went to a same-sex all-girls school, and I instantly was like, well, that's one really big issue. We're getting taught something completely different to the same-sex all-boys school next door. So you're getting two
Yeah.
different educations on it that way. I do think, though, the one lesson that's stuck, and I think it's now just like a renowned, I want to say it's a renowned UK thing when it comes to sex ed and consent, is the cup of tea video, which I have spoken about over here before, because that was done in such a clever way that it has stuck in everyone's brains.
Yeah.
And it's one where it did teach everyone about I'd say all of the different aspects that come into consent when it comes to they can consent and they can take their consent back
Yeah.
straight away, and consent's
Consent is
only,
dynamic, yeah.
yeah, and that it's only for the, like, it can be taken back at any time, but also consent once doesn't mean they've given it for the whole of their life,
Yeah,
and
exactly.
things
And
like that.
actually, that video does a great job for people that are still struggling to conceptualize what we mean by rape myths. Lots of the things discussed in that video are rape myths. The idea that you consented a week ago, or you consented to come to someone's house, clearly wanted sex. Like, lots of the issues it deals with and debunks in that video are in and of themselves rape myths. They also, did you see they made one? There's one that they made for children around consensual touching. So, you know, when do you have to let an adult hug you, touch you, kiss you? And so that's a really useful one as well. The same people made that one. Less swear words in that one, thankfully. And there's also another campaign that was aimed at children around sexual assaults and non-consensual sexual touching and stuff, called Pantosaurus, which is the same sort of thing around, yeah, who can, and you know, what is the acceptable parameters and what shouldn't be acceptable and permissible to you. So yeah, there's been some great campaigns like that. And the third sector and NGOs, including, you mentioned Leonie a few times, so Leonie from CEO of Justices Now in the UK, you know, lobbying hard, as well as lots of other incredible organizations and predominantly women leading those organizations, doing a fantastic job, that really fight hard for raising awareness and flying the flag to, you know, pushing hard for change. So thankfully we have lots of those organizations, often very poorly funded, and they don't earn lots of money to do that work. So yeah, we're lucky to have those sort of organizations fighting the fight as well.
Yeah, especially with when you're saying education is key to all of this, and her talking about the educational programs that Justice Now offers to barristers, and things like that, which I thought was very incredible, in that I didn't really realize the aspect that barristers played until I would say like this year, in that they also are invoking rape myths. I think last year when I was at university and I was completing the coursework for your module, and I was so heavily focused in on just the jurors, and that I didn't really look at the wider picture on the impact that the actual legal professionals are also playing in a court system in invoking rape myth bias as well. I was thinking of it more as just the bias that jurors are bringing in from their everyday lives and things like that, which leads me on actually to ask you, which will probably be my final question because of the time that we have reached. But in a paper that you wrote back in 2024 regarding stakeholder perspectives and effective solutions, you mention a study that was completed by Vanessa Munro conducting 4 mock trial studies, which the participants completed rape myths questionnaires prior to the deliberation. And yet some jurors who scored low on those questionnaires were found to express problematic views during the deliberations anyway. So my question is, that do you believe there will ever be a jury without a bias?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's quite a complex issue, I guess, for lay perspectives. But this is this idea of abstract versus applied rape myth. So in the abstract, people may or may not endorse rape myths. But when applied to the facts of a case, i.e. as jurors are asked to do during group deliberations, even if they score low in rape myths in the abstract on these questionnaires, they may endorse them, especially if invoked by other jurors during group deliberations. Now, we know for sure that that is happening. There is this disparity between abstract endorsement and applied to the facts of the case. This male-on-male rape project that I'm working on at Lancaster Law School, we found the exact same thing there. In the abstract, jurors didn't endorse rape myths, but rape myths were prominent during group deliberations. It was one of a number of issues. And also another study led by Olivia Smith at Loughborough Uni, we found the same thing in terms of rape victim compensation. People would endorse different attitudes in the abstract versus applied. So I personally think I'm one person, and probably the only person actually, advocating, and that might be for good reason, I might not know what I'm talking about here, but I believe that abstract rape myth questionnaires are robust and subtle enough now that we could use them to pre-screen jurors so that they're considered to be rape trial qualified or not. And so they go to the jury waiting room, they fill in one of these abstract rape myth questionnaires, and those who score extremely high in terms of their rape myth endorsement, rape myth beliefs, they can be a juror in a murder case or a GBH case or a drugs case, but they can't be a juror in a rape case because they're too predisposed towards disbelieving the complainant. Now, what you mentioned here, this complex point around abstract versus applied, would suggest, and some people have said this, I think even Vanessa Munro, who's certainly the superstar in this area, by the way, that because that there is this, even if they score low in an applied context, they may still endorse rape myths. My argument would be, let's, you know, that your question was actually, will this bias still be there regardless? I think you're right. I think it will. And I think evidence is starting to show us that. However, if we can attempt to reduce it versus remove it, then that is a step in the right direction. And so jurors who score, I actually just published a paper, I think I uploaded it today, it was accepted a couple of days ago, led by 2 other Loughborough academics who specialize in conversation analysis. And I basically worked with them on my deliberative data from my live trial reenactments, and they looked at they looked in detail actually at the conversations between jurors during group deliberations to see what happens when a rape myth is invoked. What do other jurors do in relation to it? Do they challenge it? Do they support it? How do jurors double down on their rape myths? And we found some really interesting stuff, so I'd encourage you perhaps to have a look at that one. But yeah, for sure rape myths exist and are present and discussed, having an impact during group deliberations, regardless of the abstract versus applied. My logic for this screening idea is the jurors that endorse these myths to the greatest extent are going to be those that are introducing them and leading them, such that other jurors are like to say, oh, well, I was kind of thinking that, and you know, you've said it now, so yeah, good point, and jump on the bandwagon. So reducing their impact and those who endorse them to a greatest extent has got to be a positive step, albeit I accept that it will not remove them entirely. And of course, we could have a panel of really low scoring jurors that in the abstract don't endorse rape myths, but then a defence barrister who invokes persuasively, as is their job, all of these rape myths, and that convinces some jurors. But I think it would be way worse if lots of high-scoring rape myth endorsing jurors were also on that panel. So it's about reducing bias versus removing bias. And so, yeah, a step in the right direction, but certainly not the full story. Some people will also answer those rate myths questionnaires in the abstract untruthfully. Some will answer socially desirably. And so, you know, you get ask a racist person to fill out a racist questionnaire, you know, attitudes towards race, they might not be honest. Some will, lots won't. And so there's also this social desirability issue going on. So, yeah, it's about reducing versus removing. And I think you're right to suggest we probably won't remove them entirely. But there are lots of compounding things coming together. So I actually believe this is a little bit controversial, but I think we should restrict barristers' use of rate myths during defence arguments and closing speeches, so that, you know, if we reduce the amount of jurors who highly endorse rate myths on the panel, and we restrict barristers' use of rate mythology during closing arguments, given that judges already direct jurors not to be led by myths and stereotypes, that we start to reduce their impact overall.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it, because I've grappled with just not in relation to rape and sexual assault trials, but the notion of, are we ever without bias? Can we ever be without an influence? Considering from when you were born, you are already influenced by so many different things around you, that there's, to me, it's an interesting thing of like, can you ever be a body without influence? Because we talk about the justice system as this big impartial body that's fair and just, but is that really an accurate way when we can't be like that in society anyway?
Yeah, and you're right. And, you know, that's why we have 12 jurors. If we strongly believe that jurors were fair and impartial, why have 12? We just have one, right? Because one person would get it right when instructed. So it is about these compounding different people with different experiences coming together, albeit we tell them that myths and stereotypes should not drive and impact their decision making. But is that even possible? Like, you know, from a psychological point of view, this is why I find it funny when judges say, when I instruct a juror to do X, that's what they do. Human behavior and decision making just simply does not work like that. So the conscious, deeply cautious juror may be able to do that to a greater extent, but that requires so much cognitive load. And, you know, ultimately, we're guided by our psychological scripts and schema. That's how they operate. And so for many jurors who don't want to be there and are not motivated to the same extent, it's simply not likely that they can do that. So, yeah, it's definitely about reducing versus fully removing. I don't think we can fully remove biases, even in ourselves, right? And so... yeah, it's about nudging in the right direction. I'm completely, some people have accused me of trying to increase conviction rates. Genuinely, that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to remove or reduce bias in the process. So remove it is an ambition, reduce is a necessity, I believe, such that if jurors still say we're not sure beyond reasonable doubt, because the evidence, we just couldn't get to that threshold. And when we analyse those deliberations, we don't find really that it's because they're endorsing rape myths, then that's okay. Because these cases are challenging and they're evidentially limited compared to other case types. So if jurors return not guilty rates because they're simply not convinced beyond reasonable doubt, but they're not sure, that's evidence of jurors working as they're supposed to. If they're returning not guilty rates because they think that women lie all the time and they accuse men to get access to kids and custody battles and all the rest of it, then that's not okay, because that isn't a fair and impartial jury panel, and they're by definition supposed to be fair and impartial.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I feel like we could have this conversation for so long, but thank you so much for taking the time out of your day. I know it's difficult with the time difference to have this conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope everyone that listens thoroughly enjoys it as well.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for inviting me. And yeah, also thank you to you. I have to say, you're spotlighting this issue in an important way. And I know this is part of a series of work you've done in this area and on this topic. So yeah, this is, you're having a substantial impact in the way that you're raising awareness. So thank you for giving it so much time and airtime and coverage. And clearly you've become specialist in this yourself. And so yeah, that's super impressive for your kind of career stage. So yeah, I look forward to reading your papers in the future on this exact topic.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is a place to be. Featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee, Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
And welcome back to to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, where we are just running out of time. So I just want to thank you all for tuning in and thanking Dom for taking the time to have that discussion with me. And stay tuned as we have Democracy Now! Coming up from 11 to 12. And I hope you all have a good rest of your day and week.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia. You're listening to CJSF.